Good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 16th, no, the 13th of August. I'm getting ahead of myself. Wishful thinking, I think. On a rainy day, you want to move ahead a little bit. We have a wonderful panel this morning. Mike Spain is here, Associate Editor of the Times Union. Good morning, Michael. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Good morning.
Excellent. Is that mic working or should we put him on five? Try again, Mike.
Yep.
I'm great. Good morning.
Excellent. Okay. You know, we've had this roundtable Russian roulette with this microphone since we started the show 13 years ago. Sometimes it works. Okay. All right.
There's a report that it was working.
Yeah, it was working. Good.
Okay.
Every once in a while, it does. Everything's fine with it.
Great. I'm here.
But there you are. And we hear your dulcet tones, and that's all we want to do. Good morning and welcome. Also, Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan.
Check.
All right. So let us talk about the big issues in the news and find out what is happening in this world of ours. And let us I begin with the story that, you know, I just my I'm sorry, my screen completely froze. And I had my, there we go. I want to talk about the verdict of Whitey Bulger. Came out yesterday afternoon. I don't think there were really any surprises in the verdict, but it certainly puts to rest this major case. And it was a fascinating and, very sad, terror-filled drama that played out over a number of decades that came to an end yesterday afternoon in a Boston courtroom. Whitey Bulger, the mobster who terrorized South Boston in the 70s and 80s, holding the city in his thrall even after he disappeared, was convicted Monday of a sweeping array of gangland crimes, including 11 murders. He faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in prison. He's 83 years old, so life in prison will, you know, is different if you were 30, oddly, you know, obviously. I believe out of the 33 charges, Mike, and he was convicted of all but one.
Yeah, and there were some murders they said they didn't have evidence for, and that has, you know, disappointed some of the relatives of these victims. But overall, I bet the FBI is glad that it's over, don't you think?
Yeah, the FBI was seriously compromised in this thing. We know that, I believe somebody actually went to jail in the FBI for their role in this. There was, in fact, a mess. And I like to think of this as a pinball game, which is Whitey Bulger won the game. He's 83 years old. He's past the age of death, the average age of death for an American male. We talked about life in prison, Joe. If he gets a sentence of five years, which he won't, it'll be something. And the other thing is,
it's safe to say no matter what happens, he'll spend the rest of his life in jail.
Yeah, but he won. That's the thing that really bothers me. He got away with it until the very end. He's 83 years old. Now, the other thing I keep remembering is his brother, President Bulger of the Massachusetts State Senate, was quoted during this time as this, "I'll always love my brother," or "I love my brother." Mm. How can you love a monster who killed killed all these people? You can?
I mean, no. When it's family, what else can you say? But the
went bad.
Yeah. Well, I don't think he could disagree with that. What it does, though, it gives you a great contrast to what Boston is today and South Boston is now versus what it was back then. It must have been just a terribly scary place to be.
Well, certainly within the grip of this operation, and certainly under the grip of this one very powerful, very scary bad man. There was getting back to the FBI aspect of this, Michael Kendall, who's a former federal prosecutor, said this was the worst case of corruption in the history of the FBI. For those who are not familiar, they were very close to getting him, an FBI agent, a corrupt FBI agent, went to Whitey Bulger and said, "You're about to be caught."
Right, and he
run for the hills, and he did.
But even before that, they would identify snitches, and then the snitches would die. And the trial has found that he was responsible for some of these deaths.
I would say one thing before we all agree that this is the worst thing the FBI ever did. There was J. Edgar Hoover. There was his attacks on Martin Luther King. There were all of the things that they did. I think the FBI has had a lot to answer for, especially in its earlier days.
Well, one of the analyses I saw on the Whitey Bulger case was that this was a period, the 70s and the 80s, when the FBI was infatuated with getting at the Italian-based organized crime in the U.S., and they were ready to let a guy like Bulger operate pretty much free from policing and free from the law in order to have him on their side. Although the interesting contrast is he doesn't regard himself as a snitch. It's almost like this trial was more about honor. I mean, I might have done all those things, right, but I didn't snitch on my other. I wasn't a rat, you know. And but in fact, the trial found that he was cooperating with the FBI, and he was able to operate with the knowledge of at least some FBI agents, which is pretty sad.
We call this impunity.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to the brother for a minute, because I know that you guys think I'm harping on it. But there have been stories about how some people would want to give some money to the brother just to stay on the safe side in his politics.
And he's retired, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I think when it really all broke loose, he knew he had to get out.
And that's William Bulger.
And he got called, I believe, before Congress, as I remember it, asked that question.
Was president of the Massachusetts Senate and also president of the University of Massachusetts.
That was really awful. In other words, when he was done there, they gave him a sinecure, which was, president of a great academic institution with some limitations.
One of the things that I also want to look at here is, we all see these movies. We all see Departed and all these other movies. You see all of the films.
Are you seeing Matt Damon and Jack Nicholson in this story?
Right. You know, and it's really but the reality of that is so rare. And yet here's a guy, he's on the run for 15, 16 years. They finally find him in California. He's holed up in a retirement apartment. He has like almost $1 million in cash in the walls of
his guns.
Of his retirement and a whole arsenal of weapons. I mean, it is at a Central Casting and
can't
just
make
horrifying.
This stuff
up,
right?
No, really.
Do you guys really think, as you look at his picture, that it's out of Central Casting? Because you don't see this Scarface there. You see this older guy. He looks
an 83-year-old
right,
guy.
But the FBI Most Wanted poster, that guy looks kind of like Matt Damon to me.
You could see Nicholson playing role.
You could see
sort of
hat,
being withered in the corner of the apartment.
But he looks like a Southie, from Boston.
Yeah.
And those early pictures of him, he looks, they have that mugshot from 1953. A scary dude.
Yeah. But I mean, we shouldn't romanticize it. I mean, this was
that's the point,
sad,
right?
Sad chapter in the FBI's history, in Boston's history, and there's been a few pieces written about how different it is now in Boston, and because of the big dig clearing that whole area between downtown and South Boston, it's now become a very high end area with lots of shop, lots of young professionals.
Great
moving
place.
There. Great place to be, and the old waterfront is now a beautiful harbor, et cetera. I mean, it really is a good thing that they have come out of this, and just a really sad chapter, and maybe this closes the book on it, or do you think there needs, Alan, accountability? Will there be the book about what the FBI's role was? I don't know.
I think we don't know a lot. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but Lynn Stewart, this woman who wants to get out because she now has advanced breast cancer. We had her on the air right here. There's compassionate release. So here's this 83-year-old. Anybody want to take any bets as to whether we'll see compassionate release for him?
Oh,
at some point.
I don't know. He's sentenced, scheduled for sentencing November 13th. And
He's got to be sick first. But then after he's sick.
Right. Well,
I don't know. I don't see that happening.
He may end his life in a prison hospital.
Well, yes. That's possible. There's another way to look at it. Want to bet?
Well, we'll see. We shall see. When we come back, we will continue with other stories. We welcome your comments as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org, roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from Tannery Pond Concerts, New Lebanon, New York, presenting Russian pianist Vasily Primakov and Natalia Lavrova this Saturday at 8 p.m., 888-820-1696. Mohawk Trading Post, Shelburne, Massachusetts, Native American-made moccasins, soapstone sculpture, sterling silver jewelry, Native-themed CDs, movies, and books, mohawktradingpost.com. Baba Louie's Pizza, Pittsfield, Great Barrington, and Hudson, New York, natural wood-fired pizzas, salads, vegan soups, sandwiches, pasta dishes, and gluten-free options. BabaLouisPizza.com. An Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery.
Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, and Joe Donahue, we are all here at the panel and we welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also tweet us. You can also go on your Facebook page and our Facebook page and comment on what we're talking about. We would love to hear from you. We have just been talking about the Whitey Bulger story. The other major story yesterday in the news was coming out of Washington and a major shift in criminal justice policy, the Obama administration moved to ease overcrowding in federal prisons by ordering prosecutors to omit listing quantities of illegal substances in indictments for low-level drug cases, sidestepping federal laws that impose strict mandatory minimum sentences for drug-related offenses. Attorney General Eric Holder, in a speech before the American Bar Association in their annual meeting in San Francisco on Monday, announced the new policy as one of several steps intended to curb soaring taxpayer spending on prisons and help correct what he regards as unfairness in the justice system, according to his remarks. So you ease overcrowding in the federal prisons by ordering prosecutors to omit listing the quantities of the substances.
In certain cases.
In certain cases.
When there's been no violent crimes and there's no evidence that the person is associated with an organized drug selling ring or a business basically of drug selling. And the reason is he argues that too many Americans go to prison for far too long for no good law enforcement reason. I mean, there's no benefit to society to lock these people up and throw away the key.
So, guys, why did we discover this 6 years into Obama?
Yeah, it does. Seem to be a big shift. Some pundits are suggesting that Holder is just coming out with this to to get out from under the heat that he's received for an NSA and for wiretapping reporters and for other Justice Department policies that have gone bad, like the policy where, the drug agents along the southern border of the United States were killed with weapons that they allowed Mexican drug agents to have, that kind of, crazy policies that Congress has been going after him. Well, this one seems to have support for all kinds of reasons from both liberals and conservatives. If you're a criminal justice reformer, you think it's better to spend the effort on rehabilitating people and on crime prevention and even on early childhood education, maybe.
I'm sorry, right. Joe, but we know, don't we, that people of color, people who are Latino, Latina, are most likely to be subjected to these rules. We had a president who talked about post-racial times we were in now. Many blacks and others are concerned that not enough has been done to make for equality by this administration. He wins re-election, and now we have it, which I find very interesting.
Well, are you suggesting if the Obama administration had pushed this before the election, it would have appeared to be
soft on crime?
Yeah, soft on crime, or just something that would appeal to minorities.
Well, I do think this is long overdue. However, remember that an argument was made at the time when there were mandatory sentences, that part of the reason there were some people for that was that blacks and Latinos got longer sentences than other people did.
Well, yeah. Whatever the case, while criminal justice reformers have been in favor of this for a long time, they're getting a lot of conservative support now.
That's what I don't quite understand. Because these are the same people who have been saying that they called for the stronger federal laws in the first place.
Right. They wanted to make a statement. You know, think of the Rockefeller drug laws.
Sure.
Yes.
You know, it was New York led the way on locking up people for even small amounts.
But the problem is that the people are so frustrated by drugs that they don't know which way to turn. And so they come up with these solutions which don't work. And then after a proper amount of time, they say, oh, well, let's change that.
Well, I mean, that's a good thing. It's enlightenment. At least they see that locking people up and throwing away the key is expensive and it doesn't really achieve anything. And really, if they spend a little bit of that money, or they'll try to spend only a little bit of it, towards crime prevention, drug awareness education, you know,
drug treatment for those who are ultimately charged. Right. This compassionate release program that Holder spoke of yesterday, of actually letting them, for those who did not commit violent crimes, but to actually... You know, we call this our criminal, we call this a correctional system. We don't call them jails, we call them correctional facilities. But what do we do to actually correct those who were in there?
Well, I'm so old that I remember both Rockefeller and Lindsay competing with each other before the Rockefeller drug laws.
And these are otherwise liberal politicians.
Yeah, for, you know, being compassionate and saying, okay, we're going to have drug rehab places. And they bought everything in sight, including a big fight over the Queen Mary as to whether or not Rockefeller or Lindsay would do it. I don't know that anybody ever did because they had run out of spaces. So what happened was the judges would say, you have a choice. You can go to prison or you can go to this motel and we're going to offer you services. They'd go to the motel. They would open up the window and they would jump out, you know, and take off. So the real point is, do we know any better now than we did then?
Well, what we do know is that it's very, very expensive. One of the statistics that came out of Holder's speech yesterday was that the U.S. population since 1980 has increased by about one-third, but the prison rate has increased by nearly 800%. And it is very, very expensive. So whether you're enlightened and you want to be, you know, preemptive to crime and have that approach, or whether you just want to stop spending so much money housing and warehousing people, you're getting some agreement from both sides of the aisle on let's try a new approach. So this is an opportunity to, you know, save money, save municipal budgets and state and federal budgets, but also to maybe take a more human approach to people who are found guilty of drug possession.
So, of course, we're dealing with an industry, the correctional industry. We know that. We know it in New York State. Every time we try to close down a prison, out come the unions and others who are saying this is
right. It's a major employer in some counties in upstate
New York. Yeah. You bet. Mm-hmm. Next to the university.
And then, well, we'll talk about them in a minute. And then you try to cite a prison somewhere, and then all hell breaks loose. So,
yeah,
you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't.
Right, and now we're—I mean, it's the pendulum, you know, it's swinging. But it is an opportunity. I mean, with both liberals and conservatives kind of agreeing that a long-term prison is not the solution, there could be something good that comes out of this.
I agree with you.
We are going to take a break. We will get the latest from NPR News. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. And when we come back, we'll talk about several stories, including the grad rates at SUNY universities across the 64 SUNY campuses across the state of New York, as well as some local stories. And we'll also talk about stop and frisk. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel discussion this morning. Mike Spain is here, Alan Shartok, and we always welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We just heard from Mayor Bloomberg about stop and frisk and the verdict or the
court ruling.
Thank you very much. It was the ruling was the word I was looking for. The ruling that was that came down yesterday. We'll talk about that story in just a moment. Before we do, we were talking about universities. We were talking about SUNY, the 64 system campus. A very interesting story from Scott Waldman in the Times Union today, where the SUNY system ranks high, but not without very uneven results, if you look at them closely.
Well, Scott's story, you know, notes today that a school's graduation rate tells the story of how well it prepares its students for the world, and whether you know, it supports them outside of academic courses, and whether they succeed at the school. So New York State University system as a whole does pretty well. It has one of the highest graduation rates for any public university system in the nation. However, Scott looked more closely at the numbers, and it shows that there's quite a variance across the state university system. Of course, Binghamton has one of the highest six-year graduation rates. That's 78%. SUNY New Paltz did very well, 73%, and then 72% at SUNY Geneseo. Locally, the State University at Albany has a 64% graduation rate. That means that 64% of the students will graduate and get degrees within 6 years. And it's among the higher of the graduation rates for the entire 64 campus system, but it is the lowest for the SUNY schools that offer advanced degrees and doctoral granting degrees. So, you know, while it's good, it's not as good as the others, like the university centers in Binghamton and Stony Brook and Buffalo and Geneseo is not in the university status. So,
but yeah. It is. Can I just make a point? I started teaching at SUNY in 1971 full time. Actually, 1970 part time. 1971 full time. Still am teaching there. I can tell you this about New Paltz. New Paltz was a place that a lot of people came to who really needed a spot. That is no longer true. New Paltz,
very competitive.
New Paltz, Geneseo, and Binghamton, I believe, have always been the three, in recent memory, we're talking about the last 15, 20 years, have been the toughest schools to get into at the state university. Right. So therefore, think about this, Mike and Joe. We are talking about self-selecting the best students, self-select those three places. And it is not surprising, if you think about it, that they're the ones who have the highest graduation rates.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's easy to support. When you have high graduation rates and your students are high achievers, it's easy to attract more applicants from which you can choose the most, you know, the cream of the crop.
Most motivated.
Sure. And then you continue that cycle. It's the story of higher education.
On the other hand, I have to say that when I got to New Paltz in 71, there were all kinds of characters, many of whom have done so well in life. They got a chance to come there. They got a chance that maybe they wouldn't have gotten into Stony Brook or Binghamton, but they did, and they've done so well. Some of them, my friend David Mahaly, is just retired from being an Episcopal priest, and so many people have taken advantage of that. So there's something to be said about places that offer those kinds of opportunities that may not be self-selected.
Well, so how did New Paltz, which accepted a wider variety of students, sort of elevate itself to being one of the more prestigious places and difficult to get into?
There will be people who may disagree with me, but they had a president named Alice Chandler. Alice Chandler was to higher education what Maggie Thatcher was to to politics in England. And I have to say that she took no prisoners. So she would do things like, when I got there, you know, the whole concept of, you should tell me why I don't deserve tenure. That's on you. She said, no. It's on you to tell me why you deserve tenure. And so she instituted all kinds of standards and turned the whole thing around. But look, there are a lot of people out there who don't have these opportunities, and that's one of the reasons we have city and state universities, because hopefully you get a chance to find something else about yourself.
Well, Scott, in his story today, spoke to Robert Andrea, the Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment Management at UAlbany, who says that they are having programs that meet outside of regular classes that help students who are coming in to enhance their writing skills and to help them adjust to academic life and to learn to live on campus and be part of the community. And that, they say, that kind of support is key to getting the students to be successful and graduate within a reasonable period of time.
On the other hand, I do remember a story that I heard this morning on NPR, I think it was NPR, which talked about the average amount of money that somebody had to spend, A, on tuition. Did you hear this one, Joe? A, on tuition, and B, on living expenses while you're there. So the average state university, think it's, they said something like $8,500. And right. $9,000 to just sort of take care of yourself while you're there.
Right. Between right. books and everything, they're saying it approaches $20,000.
Well, who can do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're born on Lexington Avenue in New York City and 123rd Street or something and have a mother, a single family, not all do, of course, but if you have a single family leader, your mother, you just have a struggle to get stuff on the table, you raise it $500, that tuition, and you've lost a lot of people.
Well, I mean, that gets on another thread, but there yes. are there are programs, and certainly there's people who will lend you money.
That's true.
At a very low rate for the rest of your life.
Yes, right. And that's true, except that
just
I would argue—
10,000 easy payments.
Yes, but I would argue with that one, too.
Sure.
Because obviously somebody's got to know how to fill out the forms. I mean, that's tough stuff.
That's where the colleges come in. I mean, I think they've made that very easy, but it almost becomes monopoly money.
Oh, I don't know, Joe. The Shartocks had to fill out. We actually, for the first year, Joe, after that, we just paid as hard as it was. But we filled out Pell applications. Boy, I'll tell you, you have to have a PhD to do it, and then you can't do it.
Well, I know, you know, let's face it, the colleges and the universities, they want you to come there and they want you to spend, they want your money mm-hmm. and they want that money. And they know that if you can't do it, so they do whatever they can to help you in that process and make it as easy as possible. And then at that point, then you're in,
Well, Scott points out in his story today that students who complete a college degree earn more income over the course of their career.
Sure.
And all kinds of studies back that up.
Sure.
Those who drop out leave often with debt, but they don't have the degree that gives them the opportunity to pay off the debt. And that's the cycle, I think, that you're talking about.
Well, Joe, can I just ask if you're speaking from personal experience
yeah.
in terms of this? Because, you know, it's one thing if you're a white middle class student and you come to a wonderful school like the College of St. Rose or you go to one of these places. Sure, you're going to get all the help you need. But if you're some kid on the streets and your whole emergence into a state university, sure, there's lots of money. Every year the assembly fights to make sure that there's money for those people who don't have it, who can go. But you have to know how to apply for it. You got to even go to first base. That's very tough.
So, you know, they need advocates.
Yeah.
And that's like we said at University of Albany and other state colleges, they are trying to be advocates for the students who come in, maybe not quite prepared for this transition.
But my point, succeed. And I think, these are businesses and they want the students to come in and they want the money. And the way that they make the money is to have the students come in. And the way that they make it's like buying a car. You know, you make the number and the price tag go down by extending it on the other end.
Well,
and you become the advocate then for the student of saying, well, yes, you can afford this, you can do this, because then the sale is on. And I think they make it almost too easy, because that's why you're shouldering as much debt.
I'll tell you what was too easy, but really wonderful, was Hunter College when I went, which was free. City College was free. They had more.
Those were the days.
Yes, they were, but they were free. And let me tell you, people came who would never have come if the tuition was $1,000.
Yes, and were there? What was their success rate? Do you know their graduation rate? I'd be curious.
That's a matter of great contention.
Yeah.
As you know, the City University at one point decided that they were going to have something called open enrollment.
Right.
And anybody could come. And I remember teaching at John Jay for 1 year and being told, "You don't fail anybody. You can withdraw them from your class, but you can't fail anybody. Yeah. Along comes Herman Badillo and saying, let's bring a graduate of the City University, let's bring back standards to the university, and does. But as soon as those standards go up, and more Nobel Prize winners than anywhere else, maybe Harvard, but I think it's more than anywhere else at City College, and brings back those standards. You get a guy like Matthew Goldstein, the outgoing chancellor. It's incredible what you can do. But on the other hand, how about that kid who will never go to the university?
Well, he needs to have advocacy to succeed, and some will fail, and that's as Joe was saying. There's statistically going to be people who winnow out of any competitive situation.
As I always argue with my students, and I know this may sound like I'm lecturing you, and I don't wish to because you're much smarter than I am. But my question is this. There's a big difference. You say there should be. Well, of course there should be, but there's a big difference, always is, between should and is.
Well, you know, we had a recent story by Scott Waldman about the State College at Cobleskill, which has been criticized for accepting students who fail right out, and their graduation
and
rate is miserable.
They can't afford it,
right?
So they bring them in, mm-hmm. and I mean, this is an
unlike
mortgages,
yeah.
And they pay the bill,
right.
And then what are we talking about when it comes to default rates?
Yeah, it's the highest. You know, they're at the bottom. You know, where you have Binghamton at the top, they're at the bottom, and they defend it, saying that some people come through and they do succeed, and they're the first in their family
Absolutely.
To go to college, and it's a great thing. It's the American dream. They make great successes of their life, but their failures, if that's what a dropout is, and I don't think it always is. Sometimes college isn't the right thing for some people, and they discover that. It's good information. If
well,
you discover
life
it
gets
sooner.
In the way sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, my daughter, who I'm very proud of, Sarah, has a doctorate from Princeton, went to work at a place called the College of New Jersey. The College of New Jersey used to be Trenton State. They closed it down. It was pretty bad. They closed it down, and they decided that the College of New Jersey was going to be the premier college of the state university system in New Jersey, including Rutgers. And it's now the most selective college to get into. And that's good, right? Except the downside is the Cobleskill argument.
Yeah. I mean, because it's so selective, there's many who won't have that opportunity.
Well, they could go somewhere else, which is, I guess, the point that we're sort of dancing around here.
Well,
we're going to take a break, so you can cogitate on that for a moment. We'll take a break, and we will return and talk about other stories, including Stop and Frisk. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from the Dutchess County Fair in Rhinebeck, August 20th through 25th, featuring the agriculture of the Hudson Valley. Admission, rides, food, and concert tickets, DutchessFair.com. Hudson Valley Foot Associates, podiatric physicians and surgeons treating foot problems with offices in Ulster, Dutchess, Columbia, Orange, and Delaware counties, HVFA.com. And the Sembrick, Bolton Landing, New York, welcoming the Brooklyn Art Song Society for Richard Wagner and Friends, August 14th at 7:30 p.m., thesembrick.org.
Move on to the Stop and Frisk story in just a moment. Just want to we got this letter which says the Justice Department and the Obama administration get most of their ducks in a row when it comes to new regulations and policy changes. The fall elections and ensuing outrage of voter suppression and so on prompted a lot of public and private debate. As anyone familiar with the work of lawyers knows, the legal profession tends as a whole to be very slow and methodical, especially so when it comes to layers of government. I imagine the thinking began last fall and the process was no doubt has been considered and careful. When the president or the attorney general make an announcement of impending action, their ducks are already in a row. But it took months of work to get them there. Thank you very much. We love hearing from you. Again, roundtable at WAMC.org. Let us now talk about the stop and frisk ruling that came down. And Mayor Bloomberg's been spending a lot of time with the courts, hasn't he? This is yet another
16-ounce soft drinks. Is
that's
out.
Right. It's either beverages or this very serious issue of stop and frisk. And I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on it. Here's what happened yesterday. Basically a judge ruled that this rejected New York's stop and frisk policy. A federal judge ruled on Monday that stop and frisk tactics of the New York Police Department violated the constitutional rights of minorities in the city, repudiating a major element in the Bloomberg administration's crime-fighting legacy. The use of police stops has been widely cited by city officials as a linchpin of New York's success story in seeing murders and major crimes fall to historic lows. The police say the practice has saved the lives of thousands of young Black and Hispanic men by removing thousands of guns from the streets. But the judge found that the police department resorted to a policy of indirect racial profiling as it increased the number of stops in minority communities. And the only thing I question about her statement is the term indirect. It sounds rather direct to me. I don't know.
You know, some people are arguing that crime is down and murders are down across the country and that you can't attribute all of this to just stop and frisk. There's lots of other societal reasons why.
But there are a lot of parts to the solutions to these things. If you heard the NPR story on this morning, it was fascinating. They went to a lot of people. There were people of color who said, yeah, this is terrible. You know how it is when you walk out there and you're stopped four times and you're a middle-class law-abiding person and they stop you. It's humiliating, and it is. I don't have any doubt about it. But on the other hand, they talked to a lot of people of color who said, hey, it is saving my life. It is saving the life of my family, my parents, and it should be allowed. We should continue with it because when it comes to your life or to the stop and frisk policy, there is a choice to be made, and a lot of people choose to be protected.
Well, the argument is, and one of the plaintiffs in this case said, the stop and frisk policy criminalizes a whole race and community of people just for going to work, just to get some food, going to the train, and going downtown. These people are being stopped, and yet white middle class counterparts are walking down the street and doing the same things, and they're not being stopped and frisked.
No argument.
Yeah.
I mean, no argument. All you have to do is to project yourself into, a different skin and say, okay, how would I like it if four times, every time I go out or four times in a month, somebody stops me and says, hey, let me pat you down. Let me make sure that you're not carrying a gun. It's as I said before, humiliating.
Well, it's very similar to what the president was talking about just a week and a half ago.
Right, at his press conference, saying that people want the results, but they don't want the methods to achieve those results. You know, they like the results, I think, of the crime being down, but they are disturbed by the methods being used to achieve it. So it's a contrast, and people will disagree.
We talked about drugs before. I was interested in what solution there is. You know, either you put people in prison or you don't put them in prison. But meantime, we have all these addicted people, and we don't really ever have a solution for that right now.
Well, in this particular case, it's not going to stop today. Stop and frisk doesn't stop today. The judge has imposed some remedies. She's appointed a monitor, basically a former New York City prosecutor and corporation counsel who will watch over this. And they're even talking about installing cameras on officers' uniforms.
At least five precincts will be doing that.
Spread around the city so that they can maybe have more data to evaluate how it's being done and recommend changes. They're not just throwing it out.
Well, you know,
I would argue that those cops who are wearing those cameras will act very differently, perhaps, than they would if they were not
having. Perhaps they shouldn't tell. They should put cameras on everybody.
We have them on police vehicles now, and that's I think changed some behavior. Mm-hmm. Probably, as everything is recorded.
Yeah. Which is not a which I don't I don't
accountability.
I don't use that as a criticism against the police department. I think that would be anybody. Once you know you're on camera doing anything, you're obviously going to watch.
Well, I don't know. I live in a little town, Great Barrington, and you know, we never saw, or I never saw, police on the street. We now have buffered up our police department. I don't know what the crime rate is in Little Great Barrington. I don't think it's very high, but there's always a police car going around. And I think that's got to modify some people's behavior.
Well, certainly. Yes, I understand that. But I'm talking about the individual police officers who are wearing the cameras. And again, it certainly is one of the remedies that the judge has laid out in this. She ordered a joint remedial process, in essence, a series of community meetings to solicit public comments on how to reform the department's tactics. And as Mike mentioned, the mayor has been quite defiant in all of this and saying you're not going to see any changes in tactics overnight. They are going to appeal this, or have already, I believe.
I was going to mention that, Joe. When this gets to the Supreme Court of the United States with those five judges sitting there, what do you think they're going to say?
Well, that will happen after Bloomberg leaves office, so he'll have I think the idea is that he's looking for a stay and looking for his appeal to work its way up through the system so that at least he can complete his term of office with this policy.
And several candidates, and several of the mayoral candidates have said they're opposed to it.
And let the next guy who gets in or the next woman who gets in there, the next mayor, decide what to do with it and kind of kick that can down the road.
And the governor leaves, or excuse me, the mayor leaves with a statement that is one of those statements that is obviously political, but also very hard to argue, which is, I wouldn't want to be responsible for a lot of people dying.
But if it turns around.
It's pretty emotional.
But if it turns around and crime goes up and murders go up, you'll see a change in this real fast.
Right. But I mean, it would have changed anyway, because he's leaving office. Now, how that's going to affect this, who knows? And I think you're right. I think if a new mayor comes in and the crime rate goes up, it's going to mean probably a return to some form of this, wouldn't you say?
The judge found that New York police were too quick to deem suspicious behavior that was perfectly innocent, in effect watering down the legal standard required for a stop. She wrote, quote, blacks are likely targeted for stops based on a lesser degree of objectively founded suspicion than whites.
But there was a very good story on NPR again this morning, I believe, about how black parents lecture their kids about never make a move without your hands showing, you know, and there's a whole different
it's the
way.
Talk.
Yeah.
You know, the parents
yeah,
have,
the
you
talk.
Know,
sure.
The talk, yeah, that a black parent has with their children. Yeah.
Which is, yeah, this is the discussion that they have to have, which is really a sad state, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I want to end with a story which I just find interesting because it's you know, one of those grand old stories, and it's making a return to the region, which I guess says a lot about this particular market, and that is Lord & Taylor, the merchant that has been around forever. The first time you? How old were you the first time you went to a Lord & Taylor, Alan?
I think I was in vitro.
Yes. And so you go into Lord & Taylor, and there was one here in Albany for a number of years at the Crossgates Mall. It left, and now they're coming back.
Yeah, and that people are seeing this as a good sign. They're saying that it signals that there's a recognition that this market is becoming more sophisticated. You know, we have the Whole Foods that will open next year at the Colony Center, and you have other upgrades to stores that have been here for a long time. And you know, that speaks to the economy being better. There's also some issues about, well, Lord & Taylor went through some reorganization itself and some change in ownership that maybe better positions itself to operate here. But they're going to be in the old Macy's, which was the original Jordan Marsh department store when the mall opened back in the mid-'80s. And then it became a Macy's when they took over Jordan Marsh. And across the way was Filene's, but then Filene's moved to a new store down at the end. And then Macy's over, that company took over Filene's, and that's where Macy's moved, leaving the old Macy's empty for several years. But now it will be a beautiful new Lord & Taylor, and that's a good sign. It's good competition. It sort of shows you the wars between Colony Center and Crossgates that are only a few miles apart off Interstate 87 will continue.
We are out of time, but I thank all of you for joining us and of course, invite you to get in on the conversation roundtable, WAMC.org. Mike, Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.